Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. I'd like to keep this on schedule as close as possible. Welcome to the Green Remediation Special Session. It's Special Session 1 here in Console in 2008. For those of you on the internet, welcome as well. As those of you in the audience may not know, we're webcasting this conference, and we have participants registered and listening to us via the internet and following the presentations online. We already ask that the speakers clearly name their slides when they switch forward so that those participating on the internet can hear us as well. For those who are on the internet, remember that if you do have questions, please submit those clicking on the question mark you'll see at the top of your slides on the webpage. So we'll go ahead and get started. Let me introduce myself briefly. I am Carlos Pachon with the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation in EPA in Washington, D.C. I'd like to recognize Paul Bardos of R-Cube in the U.K., who worked very hard in getting this panel and tomorrow's panel going, organized, and scheduled for Console 2008. I'll also introduce the speakers. You will have four speakers total, including myself. Three of us are here. And another speaker is kindly woken up at 4 in the morning, and she is in Houston, Texas. And she will be speaking to us over the phone from Texas. The topic today is a green remediation, although the closing speaker, Penny McDaniel from Texas, also with EPA, I'll introduce her in a second, will be transitioning a little bit to what tomorrow's topic is going to be. So I'll mention that in a second. So again, I told you I'm with EPA. I'm currently working, one of the things I'm working on is trying to, advancing green remediation best practices in the EPA, and I'll mention how we're doing that briefly. I'd like to introduce Andy Cundy. He's the second speaker. That's the order we're in. Thanks, Andy. The second speaker, by the way, there has been a switch in the speaker. It's the same topic, same presentation, but a different speaker. So who will be speaking to you today is Maurice Hansen. Maurice works in the company BioClear in the Netherlands. He has a degree from the Technical University of Eindhoven in chemical engineering, and 15 years of experience working in the field of soil remediation with a special focus on biological processes. Currently, he's a project manager and associate director of BioClear, can get involved in increasingly complex remediation projects. Andy, here on my left, he's a professor of geosciences and applied geochemistry at the School of Environment and Technology, University of Brighton in the UK. And his research and interests include the environmental behavior of heavy metals and radioactive contaminants, contaminated land, and its management. After his first degree at the University of Plymouth, he undertook a PhD at the University of Southampton, investigating radionuclide and heavy metal contamination along the coasts of England. His current focus is on development of field application of novel methods for remediating contaminated land and groundwater, which is one of the topics definitely that we'll be touching on today. And he's published over 50 scientific articles and sits on a range of national and international peer review scientific and industrial committees. And our fourth speaker, who is physically with us over the phone, as I mentioned, she is in Houston, Texas. She's there for a conference. She's located out of Washington, D.C. She's currently working in Washington, D.C. at EPA headquarters at the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, although her home is San Francisco, California, in EPA's Region 9, and she's currently detailed to headquarters. She's an environmental scientist with EPA. As a Superfund project manager in California, she was responsible for leading and overseeing environmental remediation efforts at several national priority list sites in California. In addition, she led the Clean Up Clean Air Initiative, a regional initiative in Region 9, EPA's Region 9, which, as I said, is based in California but includes the states of California, Hawaii, Arizona, and is it Nevada as well?
Nevada, yes.
Thanks, Penny. in the effort I just mentioned supports has a goal of encouraging, facilitating, supporting diesel and greenhouse gas emission reductions and the technologies thereof applied at Superfund cleanup in Rio Grande sites. She's also spent several time in EPA's Air Division in Region 9, working on voluntary measures to related to diesel emission reductions under the framework of the National Clean Diesel Campaign. Penny has a bachelor's degree in Bachelor's of Science in Environmental Science and a Master's of Science in Environmental Management Systems from the University of San Francisco. So the way this is going to work, I'm going to give my presentation first, and then I can focus on running the slides and keeping an eye on the questions that come in from the Internet. We'll probably go through the presentations and then take questions from the audience. Let me mention briefly some of the, a lot of the material I'll be discussing today, I covered yesterday. If you had not had a chance to hear it and want to learn more about it, tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, we have another green remediation session in the EPA special track. You'll be able to cover it to hear some of examples of some of the stuff, some of the approaches that I'll be discussing in more detail. But for today, I'll just have a brief presentation to introduce you to some of the key concepts of green remediation, the way we see them in the EPA. First, I'd like to start with a definition that we're using for green remediation, and that is the practice of considering the environmental effects of remediation strategy, that is remedy selected and its implementation approach, early in the process and incorporating options to maximize the net environmental benefit of the cleanup action. I think this is an important point, maybe an opportunity to clarify the difference between green remediation implementation and green remediation in the selection process. The emphasis we're putting on green remediation here is what are the options for minimizing the environmental footprint of a remedy as it is put in place. So it's not, there have been other discussions that are taking place, valuable discussions, that consider the development of metrics or evaluating and quantifying the environmental impact of remedy alternatives in the remedy selection process. And while I consider that to be a valuable exercise, currently there's still a ways to go in reaching an agreement, not only in the United States, but in other countries, and I can imagine in the EU, working across countries and within countries, across regions, lander, et cetera, it's going to be a complex process. But right now, there are a lot of opportunities, we've identified a lot of opportunities to minimize the environmental footprint of a whole suite, actually practically all the remedies that we are currently selecting and implementing, certainly in the United States. And while not every project has all the opportunities, many projects have many of the opportunities that we have that we'll describe. I am currently on slide number 3 for those of you on the Internet. This slide has a green circle, and it focuses on the core elements of green remediation. As I mentioned, these core elements, we believe, apply to all cleanup programs in the United States. There are 5 major regulatory frameworks under which cleanup takes place in the United States. If you look only at the follow the money, we have federal facilities. That is, Department of Energy and Department of Defense are by far the largest cleanup markets in the United States. They invest approximately $5 billion a year. The second is the Superfund, sites cleaned up under the National Priorities List, either by PRPs or by the Superfund itself, responsible parties, or the Superfund. That's about $1.5 billion. And then there are other major programs in the United States, just the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, RCRA. The brownfields and state voluntary programs. So we are working across those programs in the EPA, identifying where the opportunities are. Each program is different. Decisions are made in a different manner. But for all of them, there seem to be opportunities in these main areas, in energy, in air, clean air in the vicinity of contaminated sites, water resources, both quantity and quality, land and ecosystems, materials and waste, and long-term stewardship. What I'm going to do is, for each one of these, I'm going to go through one slide and then summarize what an analysis we have recently completed on the carbon and energy footprint of the five major technologies being used in the United States, try to identify where the opportunities are to reduce that environmental footprint. So if we could go to slide three, please. Excuse me, slide four. They're asking me to speak a little bit softer. I guess I'm coming across too loud for the people on the internet. Thanks for the note. In slide four, I have four bullets related to some of the core elements of the energy requirement. Four examples of elements of energy requirements related to green remediation. I'd like to start with the renewable energy systems to replace or offset grid electricity. That's one of the examples I'm going to include at the end of the presentation. And that's where we are seeing lots of opportunities to use renewable energy sources, be they solar, be they wind, or other alternatives, and we'll hear some of those today, to power the systems either directly or indirectly. Another area which is taking place at many sites is the periodic evaluation and optimization of equipment with a high energy demand. This, I think, we have been doing this across several programs in the United States, and some of you might have picked up some of the information at our booth, at the EPA booth, on remedial system optimization. There are many treatment systems that were built 10, 15, 20 years ago. For example, when energy was significantly less expensive, and when we were had less information, less knowledge about below-ground processes, they were often over-engineered. We were over-cautious. Now we have better information. We have better tools to evaluate the performance of those systems, and we can go back and revisit them and optimize them. And often we are finding that where we had 40 wells at a pump and treat system, we were just as protective with 10 wells, and we can shut off 30 wells. Same with monitoring. We may have had a dense network of 30, 40, 50 monitoring wells. With long-term monitoring optimization, we find that we can actually monitor the system very safely with all the information we need to ensure it's protective with just 10 or 15 wells. Naturally energy-efficient equipment operating at peak performance. Another example, the treatment systems often have energy requirements. There are several ways of considering this. One of them might be if you have the option is to power the system or operate the system at max capacity in off-peak hours. Not only is there a rate difference, certainly in the United States, but we're also putting a lower burden on the generating capacity, and it is at off-peak hours when more of the electricity might be coming from renewable sources such as hydroelectric. And finally, an optimized use of passive energy technologies with little or no demand for external energy power, particularly as polishing agents. But we're not saying that those are preferable over energy intensive systems. It's the optimal combination of energy intensive and passive energy technologies that we're striving to achieve. Regarding core elements of air emissions, as I mentioned earlier, Penny McDaniel and thank you. I'm reminded to call out that we're currently on slide five. That is the core element, air emissions. As I was mentioning, Penny has worked on this a lot in Region 9. We're borrowing a lot of her knowledge and experience and taking it nationwide, and that is what opportunities are there to reduce air impacts of operations at contaminated site cleanup operations. Examples are the optimal use and proper maintenance of heavy equipment so that internal combustion engines are emitting as few contaminants as possible, be it nitrous oxides, be it SOx, be it particulate matter, et cetera. the use of cleaner fuel and retrofit diesel engines. That's one of the focuses that we have had. The low sulfur diesel is still relatively new in the United States and being adopted by more and more states. So, but we can, in all states, there's the option of purchasing low sulfur diesel, and then also retrofitting equipment, heavy equipment, with the correct filters to reduce the amount of particulate matter that they emit. Another example of the best practices that we are identifying, documenting, and increasing awareness of across our cleanup programs is the modifying operations to reduce operating and idling time of equipment. That is, when we have equipment, be it large yellow iron equipment, or be it small generators and other power tools, minimizing their use when their operation, when they're not in use. And one thing I didn't mention is that we have a lot to learn from the way things are done here in the EU, and that's one of the reasons why EPA continues to come back to CONSOIL. And while it's not our line of business, we're all, impressed by simple options that are being used here in the EU, such as the automatic escalators that don't start to work until somebody walks up to them. In the United States, they're operating 24 hours a day, even if there's nobody on them. So that's a simple example, but a good example of some of the best practices that we're seeing out there, but of course transferred to contaminated site cleanup operations. And final bullet on that is to minimize dust export of contaminants. And as I've mentioned in other talks, it's not a matter of everybody not doing this, but there are many companies out there, especially medium to small firms, who may be in full compliance with environmental regulations, but we can go over and beyond them. There's more that can be done, for example, minimizing the dust export of contaminants, or even if the dust is not contaminated, the dust particulate matter itself can be hazardous to the health of the folks in the vicinity of the site being cleaned up. Move on to the next, to slide number 6. Within the core elements, water requirements and resources, the first point I wanted to highlight is minimizing water use and maximizing the reuse of water during treatment and site operations. Certain types of remedies have a heavy, very water intensive. That's probably what we'll go next after looking at the energy and carbon intensity. Looking at the energy intensity across cleanup technologies and see where the opportunities are for minimizing the water requirements as a natural resource. Examples might include or do include reclaiming treated water for beneficial reuse or aquifer recharge. And again, this is an example where there are specific regulations against the disposal of contaminated water in aquifers. And there may be some unintended consequences in those, and that we cannot re-inject clean water from a treatment system. So these are examples where we also have to identify policy barriers to some of these best practices to make it possible for engineering consulting firms and regulated entities and the regulators themselves, be they federal or state, to agree that these are good ideas and allow them to take place. Another example is native vegetation requiring little or no irrigation. There are many phases in a site cleanup that this can take place. An example I like to use is when we apply vegetative caps over landfills or other waste that's being contained. It's possible to use, particularly in drier climates, vegetation that does not require irrigation, that has low water requirements and can establish and maintain itself with a natural precipitation system. Regime. And finally, the prevention of water quality impacts, such as nutrient loading or sediment runoff. Again, these are common practices, but are we using them to the maximum extent possible? And actually, this brings a good point, a good example I'd like to give of what green remediation is and what it is not. Often when we start talking to, when we have conversations with people, some of the first things that comes to mind when we talk about green remediation is phytoremediation. There's the concept that, well, if we're using trees to clean up a site, it's got to be green. And that is not necessarily the case. That is not where we are going. This is a good example. We like to compare one treatment system to an equivalent treatment system. So compare Fido to Fido, pump and treat to pump and treat, thermal desorption to thermal desorption. How, which one is green and which one is not? In the case of Fido remediation, while you are using trees, you may be using invasive species, maybe unintentionally, but using a species that's not appropriate for that ecosystem. You may be using a water-intensive tree instead of using one that can adapt to the natural conditions at the site. You may be over-fertilizing the site to get the trees going. That nutrient, those nutrients will reach the surface water bodies and have negative impacts on eutrophication, et cetera, or sediment runoff if you don't have good erosion prevention barriers. And when you install the system, so you can see that even within phytoremediation, you can have a green phytoremediation project and a quote-unquote brown phytoremediation project. We're going on to slide number 7. This is the core elements, land and ecosystems. Similar to the previous one, using minimally invasive in situ technologies in an optimal manner, or using passive energy technologies as a primary remedies or finishing steps. But more than all, more than anything, how can these help reestablish and how can you incorporate the use of these in looking at the life of the site, the remedy to the reuse, and how can these options help you achieve a site where an ecosystem, a fully functional or as fully functional as possible ecosystem exists after you move off the site. Minimal soil and habitat disturbance. Example of soil compaction is we continue to tackle that at many construction sites, situations where heavy equipment is operated over extensive areas of a construction or cleanup site. And once we're finished with that, we have to come back and till that soil and loosen it up, because through compaction we reduce the air pockets, we reduce permeability, and we have more surface runoff off the site and less water storage, which increases the need for irrigation. Also, adopting eco-restoration and reuse practices in the document I'm going to highlight to you now. There are good examples of that. PA has documented many situations, many projects where we've considered the ecosystem restoration early on in the remedy selection and implementation. And there are many opportunities to reintegrate the natural components of a site cleanup to the nest, to habitat corridors, or other components of the existing ecosystem in the area. And then the basic concepts such as reduce noise and lighting disturbance, not only for people living in the vicinity of the site, but also for ecosystem considerations such as if there's a presence of sensitive species or sensitive periods in the life cycle of species and the vicinity of protected species. In the vicinity of the site, how might those on-site operations be optimized to minimize the impact on those species? Another example, which again is very common in many construction projects, not only in the United States, but I know it's the case here in the EU, and I believe there's a recent directive on recycling construction materials. But there are still many opportunities out there, and only because we are at a contaminated site remediation project doesn't mean we can go over and beyond. There are many technologies designed to minimize waste generation, and not only construction demolition material, but when we do generate that kind of material, there are many very creative opportunities to reuse and recycle construction and demolition debris. And again, I think here in the EU there might be a mandate to do that. In the United States, that's not necessarily the case in every state, although it is very strongly encouraged through several programs. But it's more than anything, it's the creative, it's the good ideas that have been identified in many remediation projects that we're trying to identify, document, and increase awareness of those opportunities. We mentioned earlier minimizing the extraction and disposal of natural resources. That would include, for example, soil. If we need to cap a site, where are we going to source that soil? Can we source that soil on the site, or we're going to go to a nearby farm and take off the top 30 centimeters of high-quality soil to cap our site and that other place a little bit more barren? And then finally, there are many examples, which we included in the green remediation primer, on passive sampling devices that produce minimal waste. Again, it's using these optimally. It's not that we should not use other methods, but we're maximizing the use of passive sampling devices. It definitely helps us in reducing the amount of waste and resources required just for the monitoring or site characterization. And all the triad best practices that we have some parallel sessions on certainly strive. It's the side benefit, let's say, of those best practices. Long-term stewardship, I mentioned real quick that we're looking at green remediation within the life cycle of the site. Once it's identified or it goes in as contaminated, we're going to redevelop it. Construction demolition to remediation to redevelopment to long-term stewardship. Most of the focus of what we're talking about now, because we have to set some boundaries to have a conversation, is around the remediation. But often we spill to the earlier phases of taking deconstruction of the site, and we move into the afterward phases. As far as long-term stewardship at a site, what are the opportunities to reduce emissions of CO2, methane, and other greenhouse gases in the treatment process? How can we use adaptive management approaches to integrate long-term actions in redevelopment? We're working on a document of those best practices considering engineering considerations in site redevelopment. So how can we better integrate site cleanup decision-making with redevelopment decision-making? Are there engineering decisions that we make for the remediation that if we knew what the redevelopment option is going to be, what the redevelopment footprint is going to be, we can optimize remedy and minimize the use of resources such as moving soil around the site. Renewable energy systems for long-term cleanup and future economic benefit. If we install natural renewable energy on the site, often the remedy itself does not justify the capital investment required to install a renewable energy capacity. But if the site's going to be redeveloped, and this ties into the earlier bullet, is it not possible to transfer the capital value of that energy generating capacity to the site users? Examples might be cogeneration. There are many opportunities to use cogeneration at a site during the remedy construction phase when the heat can be used to optimize the treatment system. Once that site is redeveloped, that cogeneration system can stay on site and be used, for example, to power and heat hospitals and many other uses. So we are seeing more and more cases of that. We're trying to document those, increase awareness, so that's one more option in the toolkit of greening a contaminated site cleanup. We're currently on slide number 10, for those of you on the internet. This is slide. The title is Carbon and Energy Footprints of Superfund Cleanup Technologies. As I mentioned, this is a parallel effort we have on the way to identify what the carbon and energy footprint is for site cleanups, starting with the NPL, the National Priority List, and EPA in the United States. And again, EPA does not pay for all these cleanups. Several responsible parties that I mentioned earlier do, either Superfund for orphan sites, site owners, or federal facilities, Department of Energy, Department of Defense, et cetera. But what we did is we looked at the five most common technologies that are used to treat contaminated sites at NPL, on the NPL, the National Priorities List. I don't remember the exact numbers, but to give you an order of magnitude, a pump and treat is by far the most common remedy. There are currently 500 operating pump and treat systems at Superfund sites. Actually, as there are Superfund sites, they tend to be very large systems. And we find that the average annual energy consumption is about 490 million kilowatt hours. We base this on analysis of how treatment systems are typically operated, multiplied out by how many we have, and that's how we came up with these numbers, the same for the other technologies. So what we're seeing is that soil vapor extraction, for example, even if it's a relatively small energy user, not a very energy-intensive option, even at that for that technology, we're finding many options of using renewable or passive energy systems, such as one that we'll see now, to power them, particularly at a polishing phase. On the right-hand side, you have estimated energy use, assuming current operating practices, 2030. Of 11 billion, is that correct? Yes, 11 billion kilowatt hours at energy rates for April of this year. That's about $1.4 billion just to pay for the energy bill to operate pump and treat systems. So definitely there's an economic incentive to optimize these systems, but sometimes that incentive does not fall on the right person. So we have to encourage and awareness of the opportunities to optimize them. Those five technologies, the carbon footprint associated with that energy, with standard assumptions about for the United States at a national level about how much energy is generated from fossil fuels, the annual footprint, carbon footprint for those technologies is 404,000 metric tons of CO2. Is that correct? I forget that. That's, I have to look that up. I'm going to have to get back to you on that one. But the point is that, you know, we don't know where public policy is headed in the United States. We have some ideas of where it might go, and it's a good time for us to understand what the carbon footprint is of treatment systems and understand how the different parties responsible for doing those cleanups are going to be impacted and how we can minimize that carbon footprint. We'll go to slide 11 for a quick look at an example. This is a very simple example. This is a site in Frankfurt, New York. This site is actually operated, and this project was presented to us by somebody from DuPont. What they have is a soil vapor extraction system that relies on wind power. This little windmill, which is built on top of that little house, basically it moves a piston, a large piston, and that piston, when draws up, it creates a vacuum in the soil vapor extraction system. It collects those gases in the vacuum in the piston, and then when it pushes back down, a valve closes, the other one opens, and it pushes those gases out through an activated granular activated carbon to remove the VOCs. It manages a reduction of over 9% of VOC concentrations in soil gas in 5 years of operation. They have had, and we'll talk about it in more detail tomorrow, but additionally, both setting up the system, I believe, I recall, is at a remote site, and wiring power to it from the grid would be very expensive, and then there's additional savings from the actual reduction in use of power from utilities. So just to mention, everything that I've described now is described and included in more detail in a document we released in April of this year, Green Remediation, Incorporating Sustainable Environmental Practices into Remediation of Contaminated Sites. It's available online. That's .org/greenremediation. And with that, I'll hand it off to our next speaker. For those of you on the internet, after the next slide, there's a link. Please click on that. That takes you to the start of the next presentation. Thank you. Andy, excuse me, Maurice. Andy, Maurice, before you get started, if I could remind internet participants, please feel free to, if you have any questions, to click on the question button that is on the top of your slide and submit any questions, and we'll answer them at the end of the session. Thank you.
Microphone?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Good morning, everybody, both here in the audience and also those who are very early, I suppose, on the internet, U.S., something like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. We thought we had a tough time over here in Milan, but they have, I think. We have. Okay, my name is Maurice Hansen, company BioClear from the Netherlands. I would like to give a short presentation, next coming 15 minutes, giving you two small examples without going into detail too much about the remediation results and so on, but just to show you some of the things we saw with Carlos's presentation on sustainable remediation, renewable energy, and so on. So go to slide. Okay, let's go to slide number 2. Just showing very shortly what what I just mentioned. Company BioClear, which is involved as a consulting company in mostly biological soil remediation, so it's a little bit different. It's not about biological soil remediation only. But we're going to talk about some other aspects also, and I think it's not only biological processes which are most interesting in this particular case. What I would like to talk about is a solar-powered remediation on an isle, in this case in the part of the Netherlands. Make a very quick overview of the reduction of CO2, carbon, and so on, use of energy, the criteria which are set up at the moment, and end up with a heat collector, heat asphalt collector, showing you maybe a nice example of both combining renewables together with waste. Let's go to the first example. From an oil production site in the northern part, as I mentioned, of the Netherlands on the Nile. As you can see in the photograph, slide number 3, there's a gray area in the lower part of the picture, which is the former oil production site, very nearby to the shore and to the beach, as you can see, and lower part of the picture. It's an isolated and also vulnerable location where they pumped coal from the soil, and eventually there was some mineral contamination also in that area. Basically, what is the boundaries over here, and also the restrictions when you talk about remediation, is how to proceed and how to do remediation over here with having all these kind of restrictions. I will show you what are the restrictions. First, go to slide number 4, indicating you the groundwater contamination, which is pH, protein hydrocarbons, both mobile, some part also volatile, non-volatile and non-mobile pHs, higher content of pH, also some aromatics. Then this particular site is to protect the environment, obviously, surface water, beach, remediate some contamination, also take drinkwater source, which is very nearby to this area. So if you just let nature do its job, or in this case, geohydrology and groundwater flow, something ends up in your drinking water wells, and very favorable for this area. However, the conditions for remediation should be an independent remediation system, so it should work all by itself. As you could see from the former picture, it's not very easy to access this site. Actually, I only access the site station by car via the beach, so it's not very easy from digging and dumping and so on. So that sets some boundaries to what extent you can remediate it. There's no power, no clean air, no clean water available at the site. And eventually also, and that was mentioned also by Carl, so we didn't look at presentations from each other, but there was some noise reduction and all sort of things. So that's also over here, minimal noise, also visual disturbance at your site. Meaning, for example, that wind turbines use that would not be a feasibility over here. Also, this island is very rich in birds, so it was expected that a lot of noise and disturbance with, for example, windmills are favorable for the birds living over there. So that's the set of boundaries you have to take into account. Well, some possible remediation strategies have been evaluated. Going from natural attenuation would be very favorable, I suppose, from an energy point of view. No, natural attenuation just occurring, let nature do its job, be very nice. But as you also may know, TPHs, especially the higher fractions, very favorable of being degraded under anaerobic conditions, which is actually the case in the deeper groundwater layer. Some sort of mineral oil degradation takes place in the source zone in the shallow layer, which is more aerobic. They have a problem and should be solved also. There's often most of the problem because of contamination which is flowing. Air injection, normal air stripping or bioremediation. Well, that needs a lot of energy also because you have some oxygen. And last but not least, maybe common tree. So contain just contaminant at the site and try to get rid of most of the high concentrations at the site. Right, and this one is, sorry for the guys on the internet. I forgot this slide number 6. The common treat system was eventually the one which was chosen for this particular site. There are several reasons for that. Main reason was that it fit with all the friction boundaries which are on the site. What you can see over here is a system which was very low in energy demand. Right here you can see some solar panels which were used. The tile is rather rich, well, most sunny kind of climate we have in the Netherlands, but nevertheless, there's a lot of sunshine, enough to power small pumps, which you can see in the picture over there, which are put into the wells, which already existed at the site. And by that, by making design out of that, then extract groundwater from these wells using solar energy. Obviously, also, this is a renewable energy, well, it's solar energy, but also the equipment itself can be reused. So afterwards, you can replace the solar panels and pipe. There were 2 batteries included. Of course, it rains, you have to store some energy, also pumps running at this moment, an active cold filter for treating your contaminated groundwater, which was extracted. Active phase is estimated at approximately 5 years. This is a site, well, this is not a remediation. That's correct. Not remediating the whole site. There's a lot of mineral oil still left over at the site, also after this active phase. Maybe the active phase lasts 10 years. Well, no big deal, because then you left from this system for 10 years. So it doesn't make that much difference. It's cold already and it's running. Nevertheless, with the abandonment of the site in several years, let's say 2020, that's approximately the time frame what we're talking about, then you have to get rid of the whole area, and then you can combine also something. So that's maybe the good opportunity then to find out whether you can do something in this heavily contaminated area, which is still left there. But maybe, from a risk point of view, it's not necessary to do. So this is just getting rid of all the mobile contaminants. 5 to 10 years from now, all the mobile elements will possibly base or remove, having a very energy less demanding system, I think. Okay, prototype number 7. This system was successfully implemented in 2005. Influent concentrations at the moment are diminishing, and also the concentration control is decreasing. So obviously the system works, and it has shown that it's working also within several years from now. But it looks very promising at the moment. Let's go to the intermediate part, because when we talk about carbon dioxide emission reduction or energy consumption reduction, I think it's very important. Apologies for this figure, because when looking back to my slides, I can hardly imagine that we have a goal of 30% reduction in 30 years. I'm not sure whether there's somebody of the Netherlands audience, but a little bit harsh aim goal which we have. But nevertheless, points out that we also as a country and also the ministries would like to have carbon dioxide emission reduction in the next coming years. What we actually see also at this point is already that one of the criteria for remediation and also for choosing remediations is, for example, minimize CO2 emissions. I think that's a very important one. So with what is said by colors, so try to minimize some of these things. I think the big challenge, this is more or less my personal view on this, is how to measure that. This is what we have in the Netherlands, labels for energy use, or more or less an apparatus. So this is slide number 9. Labels indicative for how much energy is used. Normally this is correlated to an apparatus, like a refrigerator or a TV set or something like that. That's, I think, also the difficult point. It's very easy to combine it with a technique or an apparatus. Of course, this can be done, even if this is done with housing. So if you want to sell your house in the Netherlands, you have to have a label which is indicative for your energy of that specific house. So it's not very much isolated, end up with an F or G label, which is rather bad for your price of the house, I suppose, but nevertheless. But saying that, I think the big challenge is more to go above that, beyond that, just techniques. And that's also what I would like to point out in slide number 10. It may be easy to find out, well, whether natural attenuation and excavation and after treatment, those are more or less, if you compare it on the boundaries of this range. Natural attenuation hardly costs you any energy. And obviously excavation does have a lot of energy demand, and also especially for example, the after treatment. But is it really true? So should we not make a question mark over here? Because it's just for the technique. Extraction really less good than natural attenuation. Why is it better than excavation? Is thermal treatment really bad, yes or no? Well, that depends, I suppose, on total area, total what you like to have in your weighing of, for example, energy demand. Just give you a short example. In the Netherlands, we have some sites where natural attenuation is occurring. And for natural attenuation occurring quite extensive way, you need a plume length, let's say 400, 500, 600 meters of space. But when you have to move your drinking water wells and put them in another place, is it really the most efficient way of doing it? Should you not take into account the carbon dioxide emission energy use for replacing those wells? So if it's something which was done already, no problem, of course. But if you have to do other things, try to get it work, it's not maybe the best way of doing it. So natural attenuation is not always green one. Also by Carlos, vital remediation is not always green. Depends on the whole set. That's also, I think, accounting for this. If you compare it in a very way, by asparging versus air sparging is normally using quite a lot of more flow, air flow, compared to biosparging. Biosparging better than air sparging? Well, from the point of view of the amount of energy used for injecting the air, 10 times less air. But on the other hand, maybe the biosparging takes 5 times longer compared to the air sparging. So the overall effect is only factor of 2. So that's making the model a little bit more complicated, I think, in real practice, find out. From a TV, television set, or refrigerator, it's quite easy. Well, it's not easy because the production side of the after treatment should be maybe taken into account also. Big challenge, I think, for the near future. So this is one of the examples, also having a project in the Netherlands. This is actually what is in progress at the moment, so try to get also some carbon dioxide emission reduction is rated also in, for example, a soil remediation. It's also a challenge. Sorry, I still forget the slide. So for those on the internet, really make my apologies once again. This is slide number 11. I think it's a really big challenge to find out what are the criteria to weigh this, because this is only... Is this only for the remediation part, or is it all in general? Go to slide number 12, last slide. Some small example I would like to show you where renewable energy is used for creating a soil in combination, in this case, with waste streams, which are already in place. The biological degradation of chlorinated solvents in... Well, as we heard in this presentation, chlorinated solvents can be degraded biologically by just putting in some carbon source into it. Obviously, that takes some energy to do so. What we also know is that biological remediation takes place quite more efficient and also a little bit faster when you elevate the temperature. Why not both? In this case, an asphalt collector, which is more or less the same as your floor heating in a house, but then way around. Come to slide number 13, last night, so eventually we managed it to mention the slides. A heat collector in Essel. This is placed there because of buildings arising this spot, although the spot itself is contaminated. By using an Essel collector, you can first put your heat into the soil, try to heat up the soil, try to get an efficient as possible remediation. This is not an investment you have to do for the remediation. It was done already for the housing. So afterwards, the houses will be fed with this energy coming from the asphalt collector. But in the meantime, you can use it for soil remediation. That's the same for, let's say, the carbon source. This is very nearby an industry which has a waste stream rich of carbon sources from food. This energy-rich waste can be used for speeding up your biological process. So this is maybe an example, and of course I'm not going to say this is the way to go, but just a small example of where combining something which was there already existing, waste, combining it with something which was also will be used in the near future as renewable energy, not for remediation, but for housing, house warming, combining it for, let's say, 5 or 6 years, remediation part, and then switch to asphalt collectors for heating up of your houses. This morning there was also a presentation from Arcadius mentioning heat storage, cold and heat storage into the subsurface, which is basically the same principle. Try to heat soil, but if you do it in a proper way in contaminated site, it ends up as a synergy project, and maybe that's an example also of use energy possible. That's my last slide, so no slide number 14. Thank you very much for your
Hello. Thank you. Once again, a reminder for those of you on the internet, if you'd like to submit a question, you need to click on the question mark button on top of your slides. And submit that. The next speaker is Andy Cundy, University of Brighton.
Well, good morning to the audience here, and also good early morning, afternoon, evening to the audience across the world listening on the internet. The internet audience, they could turn to presentation number 3 and slide 1. This presentation builds on the previous 2 presentations in this session and the general theme of the session as a whole on green remediation. The title is Selecting Gentle Remediation Approaches. These gentle remediation approaches are arguably greener, but as Carlos mentioned earlier, not always, and this is one of the things we're examining in the text project, really the subject of this presentation. So the presentation is given by myself, Andy Cundy, on behalf and on behalf of the Sumatex team. I'll explain what Sumatex is a little bit later. So if you turn to slide 2, by way of plan, I'm going to keep this quite brief, right? So I want to allow some time for some discussion at the end. But anyone listening on the internet has problems either with my audibility or with the northern twang to my English accent. Please let Carlos know. So, however, plan. First of all, I'm going to define what gentle remediation is. I'm sorry to give another definition here. Contaminated land seems awash with definitions these days, but Fred, I'm going to give you another one on gentle remediation. We're going to look at the barriers to uptake of so-called gentle remediation techniques, and then look in a bit more detail at the Sumatex project, and I'll be presenting some preliminary findings from this project. And I'll also consider developing decision support systems for selecting gentle remediation approaches, and then I'll conclude. So next slide, slide 3. So what is gentle remediation? We've defined it for the purposes of this project as contaminated land remediation, stabilization using in-situ techniques that do not significantly impact on soil function or structure, such as arguably phytoremediation, in-situ immobilization, etc. It's fair to say that these techniques have been the subject of some pretty intense research and development for a number of years. So really the scope really that I'm going to be talking about today is shown on the next slide, slide 4. And this really outlines the major techniques we're examining as part of this project. And basically on the left of the slide, we start with phytoextraction, grading into the so-called hard remediation technique of chemical soil wash. Phytoextraction, I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, is basically where they plant dominantly to extract contaminant soil medium. That can either be using additional additives, soil chemical additives to mobilize contaminants before growing the plants or during growing the plants, or it can be just using the natural mechanisms of the plants themselves to draw out contaminants from the soil. Now, moving across to the right of slide 4, we phytostabilization, where this is plant cultivation not directly aimed at contaminant removal. It's basically aimed at reducing contaminant transfer into plants, reducing the exposure to humans and other, basically other parts of the ecosystem. Then we move into immobilization, and this is essentially smart immobilization, strong immobilization. This is adding chemical additives and other additives to the soil to essentially reduce contaminant transfer into plants and into the food chain, and that grades into so-called hard remediation, whereby we look at contaminant pigmentation. And note that as we go from left to right on this slide, the lower part, green, we're looking at extreme plant concentration contaminant removal across to very low plant concentration and contaminant removal. So slide 4 really defines the remit of the Zumatec study. In terms of gentle remediation, this is slide 5 for the internet audience. Fair to say that a lot of progress in terms of understanding the plant-soil interaction, contaminant mobility and uptake, etc., has been achieved at the laboratory and at the bench scale, plus in some cases field pilot scale. But the application of gentle remediation techniques as practical site solutions is still, I think it's fair to say, in its relative infancy. And looking at this from an EU perspective, there's considerable differences in the adoption and promotion of gentle remediation technologies between different EU member states. We've seen some very interesting presentations during this CONSOIL conference, particularly from Sweden, where we've had some good examples of field-scale pilot trials of phytostabilization, etc. In the UK, I think it's from a UK perspective, it's generally fair to say that we've got a dominantly developer-led approach, UK, to contaminated land treatment and remediation. And often it's due to the timescales required for phytoextraction, phytoremediation, are too long. Okay, so if you've got a, or if it's developer-led, the developer wants to build houses or other facilities on the land, they're after a quick and effective remediation tool. And fair to say in the UK that the studies, the application of phytoremediation and other gentle remediation technologies is not as advanced as in other European countries, many other European countries. So I suppose there are a number of barriers to uptake of gentle, arguably greener remediation technologies, and these include timescales required for remediation, maybe several growing seasons. Plants need to be established and actually grow. Need for long-term site monitoring. Okay, this is something that quite often developers arguably don't want to get too heavily involved in. They want the site to be clean, contaminants removed, and you know they can build their houses and get on with life. Also, there's a degree of uncertainty in what is actually bioavailable and how to measure this. And there's been a number of EU and a lot of work in the US and in other countries on this, on how to determine a bioavailable fraction. And there's an earlier session in CONSOIL specifically on this. I think one of the general barriers to uptake, and this has been identified by a number of authors, is that of industry confidence. Now, this is a generic issue for novel in-situ techniques. Will they or can they work? Can they reliably work and reproducibly work on a number of sites? Okay, so we're now on slide 7. Continuing, what are the barriers to uptake? A number of gentle in-situ remediation options are available, and really, one of the issues is that we need some form of decision support to allow the user to make an informed decision on really which is the most suitable technique for the particular site requiring remediation management. Site management and/or remediation should be affordable, feasible, effective, and importantly sustainable. As we're all aware, sustainability gets to this particular session, and it's a topic that's rapidly rising up the contaminated land agenda in many countries. These are all factors which need built in to the decision support process. So moving on to slide 8, the need to further develop decision support systems for selecting gentle remediation approaches and assess use these technologies as more sustainable remediation tools and the current barriers to their adoption has been recognised by the funding of Clematex project, and this stands for Sustainable Management of Trace Element Contaminated Soils. And this is a cross-European project, slide 9, which was launched in October 2007 under the umbrella of SMOMAN. Now, sorry to give another acronym here. SMOMAN is not just something you build with your kids in the winter. It actually stands for Sustainable Management of Soil and Groundwater Under the Pressure of Soil Pollution and Soil Contamination. Obviously, we reduce the SMOMAN for ease. And SMOMAN is one of amongst more than 70 European research area networks, which has been funded by the European Commission's Sixth Framework Programme for Research and Technological Development. And during this project, we're working very closely with regulators and development agencies to look at, focus initially on trace element contaminated sites, to undertake a literature and project-based review, including looking at the kind of state of the art and current procedures in a range of European countries, to identify the current status of research and application of gentle remediation technologies across Europe. Now, this is the largest of the SMOMAN projects, and the consortium actually covers 8 different EU countries. And so what it lets us do is actually look at differences across Europe, differences in technical uptake, and the reason for differences in the degree of application of so-called gentle remediation technologies. So, moving on to slide 10, the general aims of the project are to derive or recommend, both to regulators and also to the contaminated land community generally, decision support systems and remediation scenarios, including verification, and importantly for this session, analysis of environmental, economic and social impact, including sustainability indicators, and also to define further research needs and priorities within this field of the application of gentle remediation technologies. Moving on to slide 11, the brief overview of the project structure. As you can see, we're looking at a range of factors here during the data collection phase, review of current gentle remediation techniques in Work Package 2, WP2, methods for assessing bioavailability and looking at environmental and socio-economic aspects of gentle remediation projects. And then in the middle row of this, we've got Work Package 5, WP5 and WP6, looking at sustainable management strategies and development of decision support systems. I've circled that in red because that's the area I'm going to briefly mention in the next few slides. And then Work Package 7, summary of future research needs and priorities. So moving on to slide 12, developing decision support systems for selecting gentle remediation approaches. Well, we're carrying out a literature review and critical analysis of existing decision support systems, such as DART, DIRE or DESIRE-A, PhytoDEC, etc., in terms of their application to gentle remediation technologies. And we've undertaken this by means of discussions, structured discussions, review, and also using a project questionnaire to assess stakeholder opinions and needs. And some of the questions we've been asking are really, are the current tools fit for purpose in terms of the application of gentle remediation technology? What input parameters, sorry about a typo here, or site knowledge such as depth, type of contamination, local geology, depth to groundwater, do we need for a workable decision-making tool? And these questions and structured discussions have been carried out with a range of relevant stakeholders in SMOMAN member states and in EU member states. They're currently being collated and analysed to examine cross-European differences. But I'm just going to present some preliminary interpretations and discussion here. As an example of looking at the application of current techniques to gentle remediation technologies, I'm going to draw an example from the UK here, CLR 11, which is the Environment Agency, the UK regulator's model procedures for the management of land contamination. It provides systematic decision support protocol. So this is slide 13, reminder from the audience there. And it's felt to be strong on cost-benefit analysis, but there's actually quite little on the selection criteria for gentle remediation techniques. On the right of slide 13, we've got a table here, which is probably not very clear for those at the back of this room. Hopefully it's clear on the internet, which is basically a matrix which enables developers, etc., contaminated land consultants, to look at various methods, civil engineering methods, biological methods, and look at where they're applicable, different generic classes of contaminants. Following that, you're directed to further information on those particular remediation systems. Very actually little in there structured on gentle remediation techniques. And generally, moving on to slide 14, again, looking at developing decision support systems, initial results from our structured discussions and the questionnaire survey we've carried out indicate a real lack of stakeholder knowledge, both on the potential and the application of gentle remediation methods. Now, this does vary across European member states, but also a lack of knowledge about decision support tools that can be used to support gentle remediation approaches. There are a large number of decision support tools out there, so maybe we're seeing a publicity or a dissemination issue, and potentially for some decision support tools, an ease of use issue as well. Generally, tools that they develop need to be easy to use. As we've discussed in this session, they need great now sustainability measures. Now, how green is phytoremediation? There's issues with phytoremediation, such as the potential future input of GM, genetically modified crops. Now, arguably, for many people, that is not a green or sustainable. Plus, also, there's need to consider aspects such as the use of plant material for energy generation, generation of biofuels, and other benefits. Now, these are the subjects of number of other presentations at this conference, and I'll also refer to the Rejuvenate session tomorrow morning, where many of these aspects will be looked at. But we really need to consider the impression that we're getting from the questionnaires and the structured discussions is the use of gentle remediation technologies, part of integrated site solutions, in combination with other methods using a kind of zoned approach. In the longer term, we're actually looking at whether it's possible to adapt or to produce a new part decision support tool as a bolt-on to be run in conjunction with CLR11 and existing national decision support tools. Don't want to reinvent the wheel, right? There's a lot of decision support tools out there at the moment which have been extensively used by other people and developed and examined. What we're after is something that we can really work with regulators to develop a straightforward tool that can be added on to existing tiered decision-making approaches. So slide 15, include. Really, gentle remediation technologies can part of sustainable land effective site cleanup in combination with other, I suppose you can term them, more traditional methods. Many current barriers to the uptake of these methods are similar to other novel in-situ technologies. One thing I'd like to flag up is the very important educational aspect involved in all this, not just in educating current practitioners about the potential benefits and drawbacks of gentle remediation and green remediation technologies, but also targeting the next generation of contaminated land consultants. A key part of the Sumatex project has been dissemination of information on gentle remediation technologies at university and at high school level. The project results are expected at the end of October 2008, and they'll be disseminated by a web portal with journal papers, trade articles. And I'll refer you to the website shown in purple at the bottom of this slide, www.riso.at/Sumatex. Acknowledgements, I'd like to acknowledge the slide 16, Snowman Aeronet program, and particularly the UK Environment Agency, John Greaves and Brian Bone, for detailed discussions and advice, and also my colleagues in the project for help. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Andy, and we are close on time. We have about 20 more minutes, so we'll go straight to the next speaker. As introduced earlier, Penny McDaniel. Penny is speaking to us from Houston, Texas. Over the phone, Penny.
Yes, hi, good morning, and please let me know if I'm speaking too softly or too loud.
And Penny, also, please call out your slides. I'll be toggling them from here.
Great. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, it's a slight shift here, and I think it's kind of, as you mentioned earlier, Carlos, transitions into maybe tomorrow's session a little bit more. I am going to talk about an effort that we have ongoing here in the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, which is to look at renewable energy potential on the various types of contaminated lands and our abandoned mine sites that we have across the nation. So I'm really going to be, again, focusing on kind of the end use of these sites, either once they've been cleaned up or while they are being remediated, so the sustainable reuse of our contaminated sites. So on to the second slide. I just put this slide up here because this is a recent development. We have launched this initiative last month. We had a Brownfields conference. That's a national conference that we hold every year that focuses on redevelopment of contaminated sites or formerly contaminated sites. And this is a new initiative that we have, relatively new, that's, again, focusing on the siting of renewable energy and contaminated lands and mining sites. The goal is basically to encourage and facilitate this renewable energy development, these types of projects on EPA-tracked contaminated lands and mining sites. So we're just focusing on our own sites, which there are many, and I'll get to some of the numbers later. And we are taking kind of a multi-prong approach in this initiative. The first is developing tools, such as the main tool that I'm going to be talking about today, just highlighting, is the mapping, renewable energy mapping effort that we have undertaken to help facilitate redevelopment of these sites with renewable energy. We are looking at development of a more legal, if you will, legal mechanisms and tools to facilitate the acquisition of these properties, either leases or purchasing of these properties where it's applicable for renewable energy development specifically, so that folks can get the prospective purchasers or developers can get a sense of kind of legal relief from buying these contaminated or leasing these contaminated sites for energy production. We're looking at providing technical expertise to assess things like technical siting issues, such as geotechnical conditions, soil stability. We're looking at a variety of different types of sites when we talk contaminated sites and abandoned mine sites. So mine sites, soil stability, slope of the property, caps that may be in place, landfills, similar issues there, and other types of industrial sites, contaminated sites as well. And we are, as we are doing here, we're kind of outreaching and trying to educate folks on what we're doing and making folks aware of what we're undertaking here and trying to get the word out and get some partnerships going. Most importantly, I think, we're trying to identify and work on pilot sites to really demonstrate the feasibility of this as a kind of a green reuse practice. And we plan to have more of this available on our website, EPA website, this summer. We're a little bit cart before the horse here in terms of rolling this out, but the work is ongoing, and we wanted to take the opportunity to get the word out while we can. Before I move on, I will, as I mentioned earlier, I'll be covering just one aspect of this, and this is hopefully it's not going to shut down on me. Okay. I'm just going to be focusing on the kind of larger scale renewable energy production on contaminated sites as an end use. And I'll just touch on, as I move through, I'll touch on the criteria that we used. I'll breeze through some of the maps that you can see what these numbers look like in terms of potential, total technical potential for redevelopment across the nation, as well as some greenhouse gas benefits and megawatt generation production potential. And then I'll end with one case study and a few examples of other sites that are being considered, being discussed. Okay, I am on slide 3 now. So you may ask why screen contaminated sites for renewable energy production potential. We have millions of acres across our country. We have a very large amount of land in this country, and we have about over 16 million acres of contaminated lands across the nation, and this is just including the EPA federally tracked contaminated lands. This does not include sites that are contaminated that are being undertaken by the state and other entities. So there are lots and lots of land available. Again, we want to define the total potential for energy development as well as renewable energy development as well as greenhouse gas benefits. We developed these maps as a tool for interested parties, whether they be renewable energy developers, whether they be the landowners themselves who may want to work with a developer to reuse the land for this purpose. And it's a starting point for further site-specific screening. And as I'll get into here on the next slide, this is a very much a 30,000-foot look at the total potential for renewable energy development on these sites. And so this is something that can be used as a starting point for these interested parties, including EPA, to look at specific sites for actual development. So there are a lot of other things that need to be considered in addition to the criteria that are on slide 4, which is the next slide, and that would help facilitate development at a specific site. So just to quickly go through, this slide is showing the types of clean and renewable energy sources that we looked at, and some folks have asked in the past when I've given this similar presentation why we didn't look at things like geothermal, and that there's really no good answer to that other than this is our first kind of take on the renewable energy potential, and we looked at renewable energies that are available and widely used. So, but that's not to say that that wouldn't be looked at in the future, kind of future iterations of this tool. So, biomass, we split up into two categories. One is biopower, and you can read there all the various types of biopower that are included in this category. Of course, there's corn ethanol, and then for wind and photovoltaics, we looked at a variety of scales, non-grid community scale and utility scale, smaller to larger capacity there, and concentrated solar power. We looked at community and utility with a couple different types of systems, Stirling and then the trough and power tower systems. And the screening criteria, of course, are, the obvious availability and quality of the renewable energy itself, the acreage, the distance to transmission lines and other critical infrastructure, graded roads, and the slope and aspect of the property. We worked very closely with our National Renewable Energy Lab in this exercise. They are basically the renewable research branch of our Department of Energy. And they helped us with the data, the renewable energy data, and we worked together to develop these maps that brought both the renewable potential and our contaminated sites together. Okay, the next slide. The purpose of the slide is really to just give you an idea of the types of sites that we have that we screened. And they all have various types of contamination, soil, groundwater, sediment, you name it, it has it. They are RCRA sites, our Resource Conservation and Recovery Act sites. I think Carlos went over that a little bit earlier. Our Superfund sites, our brownfield sites, and our mining sites, as I mentioned already. And the next slide, slide six. We screened, these are basically just the numbers. So we screened over 10,000 sites across the nation, again, with various types of contamination, soil contamination, groundwater contamination, et cetera. And this is just broken down by type of site. And again, at the bottom there, just noting there are still thousands of others yet to be included in this exercise. And why use contaminated, next slide, slide seven, why use contaminated lands? We see this as a very green reuse, a very productive reuse strategy that provides economic redevelopment value for properties that may otherwise not be attractive. Typically in a brownfield type of redevelopment in this country, most of the focus is on, what land is available in urban areas, and that typically has a much higher redevelopment value for residential or commercial or, industrial parks. This is approximately 80% of the tract sites we're talking about here are not within that area. They are the urban, the remote locations, and they don't have that kind of traditional economic redevelopment potential. So we see this as a very positive economic attribute for redevelopment, and it's sustainable as well and green. And in many cases, we have what we call institutional controls that we put on properties that may prohibit certain types of redevelopment. So in some cases, these sites may not have any options other than something that's industrial or that doesn't involve any kind of occupation on a kind of large scale. Again, this is using brownfields, not greenfields, to produce green energy. We feel is a, and including agricultural land, is a very good and responsible reuse strategy, rather than dipping into the land that is undisturbed and pristine for this type of development. And the last thing, we think that this is perhaps a very good streamlined approach to land acquisition or for leasing, long-term lease or purchase. In many cases, you have a lot of these mining sites that are thousands of acres, one or two owners to deal with in terms of acquisition versus if you a developer wanted to go out and put in a large wind farm or concentrated solar power facility, they would potentially on a green, if you will, green land, green fields, they may have to deal with multiple parties for acquisition. So a little bit of streamlining there in the transaction. Moving on to slide eight. Again, continuing the why use contaminated lands. Just getting into some of the numbers here for the greenhouse gas reduction benefits that we see, kind of the total technical potential, if you will. We've estimated that for wind production, it's approximately if we redeveloped all of these contaminated lands that we mapped that qualify for wind production, it would produce approximately 630,000 megawatts of energy, and it has a greenhouse gas benefit of approximately 212 million metric tons of carbon equivalents. And when we did the same estimate for the solar photovoltaics, there is almost 2 million, just under 2 million megawatts of energy production potential, and approximately 762 million metric tons of carbon equivalent benefits. So that's kind of the greenhouse gas, you know, potential reduction benefits there and energy production potential. And, you know, this just some of the benefits listed here, it's, you know, clean energy production. You are using less energy to redevelop land that's already been, you know, disturbed and may already have a lot of the infrastructure available, so you don't have to expend the energy or money to implement those infrastructure components. And in some cases, in some states here, if there are, you know, peak power supplies may be triggered if this is – so, for example, if there's a – during the, you know, noon hour, everybody's using all of their appliances and the utility may have to revert to kind of backup systems, and those are can be dirtier systems. So we, of course, see this as a way to reduce that reliance on dirtier peak power supplies. And, of course, the social benefits, the, you know, job creation in many of these communities. We've seen, you know, mining sites and these industrial sites where they've, you know, closed down shop. Communities are still there and that used to be employed, so there is this potential for job creation. And in fact, the National Renewable Energy Lab I mentioned earlier has developed a it's a economic model. It's a jobs and economic development impact model, the JEDI model, and it's specifically for wind power plants. So it basically estimates, it's a very cool tool, estimates the number of jobs that can be created by a wind energy plant that is installed. And then, of course, the renewable energy contributes to meeting our goals of national energy independence and security as well. And so I'm going to breeze through these next few slides. These are just some examples. So I'm on slide 9 of the maps that we've developed. These are all GIS, Geographical Information System-based maps. We have all the backup data that's available for the that generated these maps. But this just gives you an idea of, for example, here, the community scale, that's about 20 – ranges from about 25 to 50 megawatt generation, wind generation potential. You can see here that we have a number of our contaminated sites that screened out, if you will, that qualified, if you will, for this level of and type of renewable energy development. And you can see in the screening criteria a little bit more of the specifics. It has to have a wind power class of 3 or more. Property has to be, it's kind of a large range, but between 100 and approximately 2,000 acres of land, distance to graded roads, 25 miles, and et cetera. And moving on to the next slide, just an example of one of the states. It shows here Colorado for community wind, and as you can see, some sites were screened out there. Next slide. Slide 11 is our photovoltaic potential, which not surprisingly is located mostly in the west and southwest, which is where we get a lot of sun exposure there. And the next slide is California, which I apologize, I didn't scale properly, so it looks distorted. And you can see here, just on California, I mean, we have abandoned mine lands that screened out, brownfield sites, RCRA sites, some of our federal lead Superfund sites, and our non-federal lead Superfund sites. So we have a wide range of our contaminated lands that screened out for this type of renewable energy development. The next one is CSP, or concentrated solar power. And the next one is New Mexico for CSP as well, utility scale. And then, of course, we did the biomass, and those are the next two maps. I'm not going to go through all the screening criteria. You can read through those. We combined here the map showing the dry mill corn ethanol as well as the kind of cumulative biomass residue potential across the country. And slide 16, I think we're on now, shows the biomass energy generation potential for the state of Pennsylvania as an example. Okay, so moving on to the next slide, there are a variety of incentives for not just renewable energy development, but also for contaminated lands redevelopment. And this is just to highlight that those types of incentives do exist in each state, and it varies quite a bit by state. There are some limited federal incentives, but it really falls at the state level at this point. Also, I think it's really important to note that each state, I think it's 32 states at this point, at least last I checked, have adopted renewable, what we call renewable portfolio standards, which are basic requirements that a state either produce renewable a certain percentage of renewable energy or use energy from renewable sources by a given date. So they set goals for renewable energy production and use. So that it seems to drive this type of green redevelopment. And the next slide, on that previous slide, there's a great database. It's the database for state renewable incentives at the bottom there, to check that out if you are interested at all. And so on the next slide is just an example of, we pull together all the incentives that are available in each state. Again, for on the left-hand side of the slide, you see incentives for clean and renewable energy, and on the right-hand side, you see development of contaminated lands incentives. And the idea, again, is just to marry the two so that folks can see there are a lot of not just financial, but net metering type of incentives, as well as equipment loan programs and things like that, to assist in this type of green redevelopment. Okay, in the next slide, 19. This is an example of a wind energy development project on a Superfund site. It's the former Bethlehem Steel Superfund site in Lackawanna, New York. Currently, it has 8 wind turbines, very large wind turbines. Sorry for the photo. It's I had to shrink it down to fit it onto the slide, but you can probably enlarge it on your own screen and see that they're off in the background there. And this is the former steel facility there. And they have great wind. It's right off of Lake Erie. Great wind generation there. They produce about 20 megawatts of energy, enough to power approximately 7,000 homes. They're projecting that they will increase the number of turbines by 10 to achieve a 45 megawatt generation capacity by the year 2010. On the jobs front, this is these are domestically manufactured wind turbines, manufactured in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and local job creation on a site that was abandoned and not being used and pretty much fenced off. So there's local job creation for maintenance of the site and things like that. And the next slide just shows some sites that we're working on now are kind of in the works or discussion pipeline, if you will. The first one is the Summitville mine site and Peru Creek / Pennsylvania mine site. This is a site where they are going to install a microhydro generators to produce the electricity that's needed, all of the electricity that's needed to power the water treatment system at the site. So although it's not exactly a large-scale renewable energy development that's going to be fed into the grid, it is not taking from the grid. It is you know, producing its own renewable energy with these hydro generators on site. And the Dover landfill in New Hampshire, they're evaluating development of a solar production facility. It's a 50-acre landfill. And then there's the there are many other examples here. These are just some ones I'm highlighting. The Hacienda landfill site in Arizona, Buckeye, Arizona, there are a couple options that have been discussed on the table. It's a landfill that's approximately 70 acres closed, and it's in Arizona, so it's in the desert, not a lot around, except for a lot of farms and feedlots for dairy and beef cattle production. And so there's some discussion of developing either a digester or a gasification type of energy production system using the ag wastes in the area. And there's quite a bit of potential. There's multi-megawatt power production potential there in that scenario. There's also been some discussion on siting an algae farm, of all things, in the desert in a kind of an enclosed system. And for production of high-grade fuel oil production on the site. So some possibilities there still in discussion. And that's it. My info is on the last slide there. If you have any questions, my email is there. I also included a general email box that we set up if you'd like to have perhaps a faster response, because I'm not the only one that can access that email box. So I thank you for your time and attention, and we'll take any questions.
Thank you so much, Penny. Let me just make a couple of announcements. I know many of you have to leave early to get on your tours. Just so you know, this session will be archived, both the audio and, of course, the presentations, on Kluin.org, so at any future date, if you want to review or share some of this with your colleagues, as well as everybody's contact information, will be on there. So you can go through these slides again, and the audio of this conversation will be stored together with it. I'd like to start off with, are there any questions for Penny? Okay, no questions here. Let me, I have a question, let's see, for Maurice. This is from Calgary, Canada. Question is, in the use of asphalt heat collectors, how would you consider issues such as soil permeation and the aesthetic quality of the landscape?
Sorry.
Yeah, in the use of the asphalt heat collectors? In the use of the asphalt heat collectors, how would you consider issues of soil permeation and aesthetic value or quality?
Well, aesthetic value, as far as I know from the asphalt collectors, it's completely underneath of your area, so you actually hardly see anything of the asphalt collector. I'm really not sure where I'm having the question right, but it's completely underneath the area, so you don't hardly see anything of the system itself. It's fully integrated in the asphalt and also in the course or in the subsurface.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for the panel from those of you in the audience? Yes, Paul Bartos.
Carlos, I have a question for you and Penelope. But first, can you spell out for people the web address? Because not everyone caught the web address where the presentations were.
Yeah, what I'll do while I answer the question is I'll write it on the screen so nobody has to actually type it.
Okay, well, my question is, how far do you think that the potential green energy savings that Penelope has been describing could offset the energy use that you mentioned in your slide set from the five principal technologies being used to manage those Superfund sites. Are we in benefit or deficit?
Good.
Yeah, can I take a shot at that? I think we're definitely in benefit and then some. There's a multiple millions of, as I mentioned, megawatt generation potential and greenhouse gas benefits associated with the total potential. In other words, if we redeveloped every site with renewable energy, we would have these million of megawatt energy production potential and greenhouse gas benefits. And I think that that's a benefit in terms of a surplus, if you will, in terms of our impact on those two components, energy and greenhouse gases, from our remediation systems. Carlos?
Yes, I agree. Thanks for the question, Paul. And I agree, just it's the first time I thought of it myself. As I've hearing what Penny was saying, we don't have too many chances to talk on these topics. It's good that we have these events. But indeed, I think there's definitely a tremendous surplus. Yes, we have a question.
Hello. Just to follow up on that, so is that generating capacity mentioned, was that a net capacity, sort of assuming or calculating the amount of energy required to undertake remediation on those millions of acres, or was it a, if we assume, zero energy requirement for remediation?
No, if I understand the question right, all we're doing here, this is comparing the number that, the estimate that we came up earlier for operating the five major treatment systems being used at national priority list sites versus the renewable energy capacity at contaminated sites if we installed 100% capacity. So that's a potential number. The amount of energy actually being used is a real number. So we're comparing a potential to a real.
And another question while I've got the microphone. What percentage of the total U.S. energy requirement could be generated from these lands? And, I mean, how attractive is it to the U.S. government?
Penny?
Yes. Well, I don't think it's an enormous amount of the energy that we consume, but it is, again, as I mentioned earlier, we have a lot of these policy drivers, if you will, or drivers that are policy-based, the renewable portfolio standards just being an example that are driving it statewide in various states. I can't really speak to the overall federal government but in terms of its appeal, but this is definitely something that EPA is very interested, obviously, in promoting and pursuing and encouraging strongly. As we, you know, move forward into an era of, carbon conscious world and country. I think this is something that will only grow in its appeal.
Thanks, Penny. One more question. This one's from Arlington, from Virginia, in the States. It's for, I believe it's Randy. Yes. What is the scope, or universe of sites or remedies that you'll examine as part of this project? And are regulatory bodies suggesting projects or sites, or are they accepting nominations to review these from the private sector?
That's a very good question. Basically, we are reviewing a range of sites across the EU. We've been directed towards some of these sites by the regulators, but we welcome input from the contaminated land community. We're basically looking at examples of best practice globally, essentially. So we're focusing mainly on Europe, but if there's any input from the US or from other countries, that'd be great to receive.
Thanks, Andy. Other questions from the audience?
Question for Penny. I just wondered what you felt the possible opportunities were for using contaminated land for production of non-food crops for biofuels, particularly maize for ethanol, and thereby offsetting the potential ethical issues associated with using agricultural land and food for biofuels for transport?
That's a tough one. So are you asking kind of like what is the potential for maybe something like switchgrass or non-food crops for energy production on contaminated lands? Is that right? Make sure I understood the question right.
Yes, that will be one. But any other opportunities to grow other crops like maize, for example, on land which is potentially too contaminated for agriculture or food production but would be suitable for plant growth?
So I don't have exact numbers on that, but I know there are definitely efforts, particularly in the Northeast. There are some states that are collaborating on looking at kind of old coal mine sites, believe it or not, and rehabilitating those sites with things like switchgrass production. Nothing has been discussed as far as I know. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist for other types of crops, but this one was focused really more on switchgrass production for fuel, specifically on former coal mine sites. So there are things going on. I don't have numbers, but I can certainly look into that and get back to you if you'd like to email me.
Thank you, Penny. We're way over time here, so unless there's another urgent question, I will let this question as a segue to tomorrow's presentation and tomorrow's panel at 11. The topic is actually brownfields, bioenergy, and biofeedstocks. We'll be looking at this in addition to an interesting work that's also being done in the United States on evaluating the carbon sequestration return, quote-unquote, from using soil amendments to recover contaminated lands, and is that, you know, possible offset similar to using renewable energy, using offset carbon offset. So we'll explore that a little bit and other topics tomorrow at 11. Thank you all very much for being here, and thank all of you on the Internet for participating in this panel. Bye-bye.